Well, it's good seeing you this morning. This is a final installment of our discussion of the modern history of Israel. And today's kind of a mop-up day. You're going to have to allow me to go around a little bit because there's some things I want to share with you that perhaps we missed that I want to tell you a little bit more about. But we'll get all the way to the present day, I promise you, as we go through this modern discussion of Israel. And I want to remind you again the premise, the idea that today the people of Israel, while we know that they are secular, they're not religious people that live in this country. More people in Israel will push the button of non-religious than any other button that is there. A very small percentage of the people in Israel are Orthodox Jewish, perhaps 20% or probably even less than that. But most people are either traditional or just non-practicing as a whole. But inside this idea of how is it that we could say to the world that Israel is something that belongs to the Jewish people, the first thing is, and we looked at it our opening day, was in the book of Genesis, and the idea that God has given this sacred piece of property to the people of Israel, the Jews themselves. And that's their first premise. And I think it's a pretty good premise. And like we came to the conclusion of last week, is that perhaps the people there today are not biblical Israel, the people themselves. However, the land promises that were made to Abraham certainly feel like there's a sense of fulfillment in this piece of property being given back to the Jewish people officially in 1948. Secondly, we see Jewish people settled and developed the land. We went through the history of that together, the biblical history of it. Thirdly, the international community granted political sovereignty in Palestine to the Jewish people. That was through Balfour. That was also through the United Nations. And so there's a sense of the world leaders and nations behind it. And finally, there were parts of the property, specifically in the Six-Day War of 1967, that were captured in defensive wars, is what the Israelites would call those wars. And here's our history again, and this is really important as you look through the modern part of it. And we talked about the Ottomans, and in 1918 to 48, we talked about the League of Nations and the mandates that were provided there. In 1948 to 1967, we see two of the most important wars. Remember, we talked about the 1948 war, which was the War of Independence, and then the Six-Day War of 1967. Now, one of the things I wanted to remind you about in the War of Independence, there were two things that happened. One in the War of Independence and one other thing that happens in the 1967 war that both involve ships. And one of the ships is a ship called the Altalena. Now, I think I have a picture of the Altalena. This is the Altalena right here. And in the midst of the War of Independence, a man by the name of Menachem Begin, who was the Irgun commander. Begin was a guy that was a terrorist. He was a right-wing fundamental terrorist. He had an opportunity to get a whole bunch of weapons to assist in the war with the Arabs, and he does so. And June 15th of 1948, he tells Ben-Gurion that he's got these weapons and they're coming from Paris. And actually, they dock in Kfar Vitkin. And if you know where that is, if you've been to Israel with me, you've been to Caesarea Maritima. Kfar Vitkin is very close to that on the water. The Altalena docks there, and the crew starts taking the cargo out. Begin makes a deal with Ben-Gurion and says, well, at least 10% of the booty goes with me so I can defend Jerusalem, because that was Begin's big thing, was to defend Jerusalem. And they start transferring some of these. The government now is in session, and Ben-Gurion and some of the others are beginning to think, man, we've got all of these ceasefires in place. We have all these rules in place. We probably shouldn't go do this. And they turn on Begin, and next thing you know, the IDF goes after Begin and goes after the Irgun. They have a fight. This is outside of Tel Aviv, actually, because the boat or ship moves to Tel Aviv. And you have the IDF against the Irgun, and probably about 28 people get killed. And then finally, Ben-Gurion says, that ship's on fire, and he ordered the IDF to sink it and to kill the people that were there. And the IDF looked at Ben-Gurion and said, those are our brothers, and this madness must stop. And it did. And it stopped a potential civil war between the Irgun and Menachem Begin and David Ben-Gurion. But there's a picture of that. It's kind of a world-famous picture of the boat on fire, and eventually they take care of the problem. Now, the second thing about a ship that I never told you about happened in the 1967 Six-Day War, and it involved this ship right here. This is the Palestinian police force most wanted people. Guess who number one is in the post office? See this guy right here? You know who that is? That's Menachem Begin. He is the most wanted terrorist during the time of Palestine, during the time of this Altalena altogether. And it's miraculous during the Six-Day War that Begin and Ben-Gurion actually become somewhat friends through the process. Now, looking at this ship, this is a Liberty, the USS Liberty. It's a United States intelligence gathering ship. It was steaming about 10 miles off the Egyptian coast, and it was there during the fifth day of the Six-Day War. What happens in short form is that this ship should be 100 miles offshore, but due to some miscommunications from our government to the captain, the ship is 10 miles off. The Israelis mistake it. They think that this ship is Egyptian, and they start firing on the ship. 34 U.S. naval personnel are killed in the attack. Another 171 of our men were wounded in this. This was quite a big problem, if you could imagine, for the Israeli people. There were multiple investigations. The CIA report found no malice. They said it was an accident. The U.S. Navy of Inquiry, mistaken identity. A report by Clark Clifford himself at that time, there was no evidence that the ship was known to be American. Later on in the 80s, the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence said there was no merit to claims that the attack was intentional by the people of Israel. The NSA in 1981 also did another one, the House Armed Service in 1991. All of them came back with the same conclusion that this was accidental. And Israel ended up paying reparations to the family members that were lost and to the government as a whole. Two ships, two wars. I wanted to tell you about something else as we fast forward here. Remember I was talking to you about the election, and I told you that Benjamin Netanyahu had the opportunity for 14 days to form a government? Well, he couldn't do it. And so he reported back and said, no can do. And he is running against a guy by the name of Benny Gantz. And Benny Gantz is in the Blue and White Party. You can see he has 33 seats. The Likud party, that's the party of Benjamin Netanyahu, has 32. So he has one more. But this is what's called a unicameral system of government, parliamentary. What that means, uni means one. So there's not a Senate and a House of Representatives. There's just one body altogether. So there are 120 seats. This is a 2019 election. You need 61 seats to have a majority, which has never happened in the history of this country. Never. No one ever gets 61 seats. And so the MP with the largest number of seats is tasked with forming a coalition. So if you get 31 seats or 32 seats, like Benjamin Netanyahu's party, he had to go to all those other parties to see if he could get a majority and get those people to work in a coalition. And it's a lot of fish trading, right? It's just like, well, I'll join you if you do this for me. And Netanyahu's burned a lot of bridges in government, so for him to put a government together is right now a very, very difficult thing. So now Gantz is on the clock, Benny Gantz is. He has 2 weeks to negotiate with all these other people and see if he can form a majority. The chances of that happening are slimski and nunski. And what is going to happen next? Thought I would bring some Russian back into this. What will happen next is that the people of Israel will have to go back and do another election. And in the midst of it, if you're following very closely, you know that Benjamin Netanyahu and his wife are facing an internal investigation for all kinds of things that their political adversaries are pushing before them, which also might have an influence on it. But Benjamin Netanyahu is a pretty tough dude. And every time I see this kind of numbers and these things and these challenges before him, he somehow finds a way to kind of worm his way back into that into the seat and running things. But this is how their government worked. This is how their government's worked since 1948. And you'll find out all the way from 1948 to 1977, and we'll find that out here in a little bit, that they basically were all socialists, and they were all secularists. They had nothing to do with the religion, and they had more of a socialistic idea of how to economically run their country. In 77, Menachem Begin comes in, and he's the first conservative in the history of Israel to be elected by the people to say, hey, let's see if we can push this in a different direction. And then I provided again the Mapé party. You see that right up here? These are all labor, all the way to 77. These are all economically socialistic prime ministers, and their cabinets and their governments are set up that way. And then you can see Menachem Begin in 77. That changes quite a bit in their country. All right, when we left off last time, Six-Day War, 1967, the Israelites pick up the Sinai. Remember this whole area right here? And this is oil rich, and they took it from what country? Egypt. And then the West Bank was where they took all the Jordanians, and they defeated the Jordanians, and the Jordanians went running across the Jordan River back to Ammon. And then up here, they defeated the Syrians for the Golan Heights. So I told you, if you go to Israel with me, we think about the Golan Heights, we think about being up in Galilee, and we go to Caesarea Philippi, we go up in the Golans, all the way up to the border of Syria, because we can do that because of the 1967 war. And if you went with me here in the West Bank, you say, did we go to the West Bank? And certainly you went to the West Bank if you went with me to Jericho, if you went with me to Bethlehem, and if you went with me to parts of Jerusalem as well. And that is the West Bank. So that's the result of the 1967 war. The Arabs are not happy with what they have. And the next war is called the Yom Kippur War. Now, Yom means day, and Kippur means atonement. So this is a holy day for the people of Israel. It's called the Day of Atonement. Another holiday that's right around this time, which is the beginning of the new year for the people of Israel, which is in September, early October, is Rosh Hashanah. Have you heard that before? Rosh means head, Shoshana means year. It means the head of the year, the beginning of the year. Now, the Yom Kippur War, if you looked at it, if I showed you how it started and how it ended, in terms of land, probably not going to change a lot. Matter of fact, it doesn't change anything. But it does change something culturally for the people of Israel. The people of Israel at this time have a swagger. They haven't lost any war. Remember how amazing it was that they won in 1948 and how amazing it was that they won in 1967? Well, they start building up a little bit of an empire and a gigantic attitude. And the people that are the kids, this next generation, they know nothing but victory over the Arabs. So for them, this war right here, the Yom Kippur War, was really difficult for them to swallow. Because in this war, they actually got pushed back pretty hard. In this war, they had a lot of people that died. And on television, they watched a lot of funerals. And they watched POWs for the first time being pranced around by both the Egyptians and the Syrians. And so this was a big problem. Now, Yom Kippur, if you go to Israel with me, if we happen to be there in Yom Kippur, everything shut down. Now, remember earlier I told you that the people are mostly secular, but it's much like a holiday here that we call Christmas. Everything gets shut down for Christmas, but most people are not looking at the real meaning for Christmas, going, oh, this is the birth of our Lord and Savior, Jesus. They're saying it's another day off on the calendar and we can have some fun and we don't have to go to work. And for the people of Israel, it is the same thing here for the Day of Atonement. Now, the war begins this way, and it's our same group of people, right? Remember the people that we have, the Arabs, that don't like the Jews, that want to kill them and destroy them? You have right here the Egyptians, and then at the top of the screen, you have the Syrians. Now, the Jordanians are kind of just sitting back on this one. They've gotten their nose bloodied a couple times, and so they're kind of watching from the sidelines, and they're kind of like bullies that if it kind of goes and swings the way of the Arabs, they're probably going to join in, and otherwise they kind of sit out and watch from the side. And so the initial attack comes here from Egypt. Now, this is a surprise attack, this Yom Kippur attack. But yet the people, the politicians, most of them that are in charge of the government and the military of Israel have had plenty of warning for buildups of both Syria and Egypt. Tons of it. Golda Meir, who was the prime minister at the time, has been told sternly by the United States of America, you are not to have any more surprise attacks. We will not stand with you. We will not give you anything. No more surprise attacks. So her military advisors are going, hey, there's an Egyptian buildup that's happening over here, and there's one that's happening here in Syria. Can we just launch one of our, you know, all of our F-18s and F-15s and go blow everything up and win this thing and do it right away? And she was like, no, we can't. There's a Cold War happening, and the United States is aligned itself at this point with Israel. The Russians are aligning themselves somewhat in a fractious relationship with the Egyptians and a closer relationship with the Syrians. Now, if you follow the newspaper today, are you surprised that the Russians are defending the Syrians? They have all the way through the Cold War and before. So this is a relationship that the Soviet Union had, and now the Russians have as well with the Syrians. So both of these large governments are ready to go. The people in Israel, the main people that are there, the population have no idea this is happening. And what happens? Air raid. Air raid sirens everywhere. And everyone turns their televisions on, most of their radios on, and they say something that nobody ever wants to hear. This is not a test. The Egyptians are in the Sinai, and the Syrians are in the Golan Heights. We're in trouble. And so this war goes. And what happens is the first couple of weeks of it are very, very bad for the Israelis. The Egyptians push into halfway through. They go over the Suez Canal, halfway through the Sinai. The Syrians immediately take over all of the Golan Heights and reclaim it. But like a lot of things, you know, it takes a little bit more time to kind of figure it out. The Israelis, after being knocked on their backside, get back up. They decide to focus on the Golan Heights. They immediately take the Golan Heights back. And if you went with me, I think I showed you some of the tanks that are still sitting out there on the Syrian border. You got to see, if you went with me, at least one of those. And they take the Golan Heights back. And then the Israelis are like, you know what? We're not going to stop at the Golans. Let's go to Damascus, shall we? And they start rolling towards Damascus. They're 30 miles outside of Damascus. And also at the same time, they push back the Egyptians, and they push them back to the other side of the Suez. So all the land stuff is the same. The United Nations is calling. The Russians are going nuts, and the Russians are threatening the Americans, going, you better stop the Israelis from going to Damascus. And what happens for the Russians is they've got a whole bunch of their stuff starting to fly into Damascus, and they're ready to go. The world at this time, there are many people in the world that believe that this was the beginning of World War III. And they thought, okay, well, here we go. You know, we got all these coalitions, we have these alliances, we have the Israelis on one, we have the Arabs, we've got the Americans, and we've got the Russians. And what's interesting is recently, the president at that time was Richard Milhouse Nixon. And recently, some of his discussions with Henry Kissinger and Bob Haldeman, who's his chief of staff, were declassified. And I have some for you, some quotes of what those guys thought about the Yom Kippur War, and most notably what they thought about Israel in itself. Now remember that Henry Kissinger is Jewish, you know that. And this is Kissinger talking to Nixon and talking about the idea of Jewish people not being able to leave Russia and Jewish people having to be forced to go back to Russia. And this is Kissinger talking to Nixon, quote, "The immigration of Jews from the Soviet Union is not an objective of American foreign policy. And even if they put the Jews into gas chambers in the Soviet Union, it's not an American concern." Nixon complained to his chief of staff, Bob Haldeman, in an Oval Office meeting, the Jews are all over this government. And Nixon said the Jews need to be brought under control by putting someone who's not Jewish in charge. Every one of these agencies here are run by Jews. Washington's full of Jews, the president asserted, and most Jews are disloyal. He made exceptions for some of his top aides, like Kissinger and White House counsel Leonard Garment, who is Jewish, and his speechwriters, William Safire and others that were. But he said, Bob, generally speaking, you can't trust, and I can't use the word here because we have a clean environment at the class, but you can't trust these people. They turn on you. Am I wrong? Am I right? And Haldeman agreed wholeheartedly. He said, their whole Jewish orientation, it's against you. And in this administration anyway, and they're cunning, and they're smart. They have the ability to do what they want to do. And right now what they want to do is they want to hurt you. All the way from the Oval Office. You ever wonder what presidents and their administrations talk about, and then they get taped, and then you get to listen to them some 40 or 50 years later. But that's what I think. The Kissinger comment, you know, he had to actually take an interview on that a couple of months ago, and his interview wasn't really, really good at all. Matter of fact, it was pretty bad. But that's a pretty tough comment here, you know, Henry Kissinger say something like that. But this is the Yom Kippur War, so what you need to remember about it, surprise attack, the government knew it was coming, the people didn't know it was coming, the first couple of weeks were really bad for Israel. It also took a group of people that had a real swagger, knocked them into the ground, their first funerals, their first POWs, their first time of feeling loss. But at the end of the day, the land, right back to the 1967 Golan Heights, right back, West Bank back, Sinai right back. All right. In the Arab countries, they can't win in conventional wars. They've tried three times. They tried in independence. They tried in 1967. They try again at the Yom Kippur War, and they come up losers each time. They're not able to do it. So Arabs have got to find a different way to solve the problem. And the way to solve the problem, the best way would be peace, right? Come to the peace table. Let's talk about it. But what they choose is a different path, and it's called terrorism. And Arab terrorism is an alternative to conventional war. I want to give you some examples of some of the terrorism that was facing the people of Israel and, frankly, people of the world. On the 23rd, 1968, LL Flight 426 en route from Rome to Tel Aviv was hijacked and flown to Algeria. Now, let me stop there for a second for those of you that fly in LL Airlines, and I'm one of those people. It's a great airline. It is one of the most secure airlines in the world. I've taken people on that airline, and they're looking at me going, how many more times do we have to go through security check? As many as they tell you. This is the only time in history here in 1968 that LL has ever had an airplane successfully hijacked. First time, last time. There were only 38 passengers on board. There had been a mechanical issue, and some of the people ditched off the plane. And so shortly after takeoff, two of the three hijackers, they burst into the cockpit. They had guns. Now, the hijackers were members of the Popular Front for Liberation of Palestine, which had been founded in 1967 by George Habash. H-A-B-A-S-H. We don't have a lot of time to go into George's background, but there's a picture of him. He's the guy that is got the mustache on the opposite side of Yasser Arafat, and he's the brains. He's the architect behind a lot of the hijackings and a lot of the terrorism that happens during this time period. Now, the plane lands in Algeria. The aircraft, its passengers, become captives of the Algerian officials. 23 non-Israeli passengers are released, but there's a remaining 12 Israeli men, and they remain passengers of the Algerian government until September 1st. Now, remember, they're hijacked July 23rd, so a little bit longer than a bad layover at O'Hare Airport. And they're released following an international aviation boycott. The international community said, you know, we're going to boycott Algeria. And the Israelis released 16 Palestinian prisoners. Then, on September 6th, The hijackers, who demanded the release of the Palestinians in Israeli jails, managed to take control of three planes and force them to land at a place called Dawson's Field. Dawson's Field. And I think there's a good picture of hijacking in the 60s and 70s, nothing like it. And so this is Dawson's Field. If you wonder where Dawson's Field is, it's outside of Amman, Jordan, and it's in a town called Zarqa. This is an old British airfield that had been in place for a while. And what happens is the planes were operated by TWA, Swiss Air, BOAC, which later becomes British Airways. And a fourth plane, a Pan Am aircraft, which was flown to Cairo and blown up after all the passengers disembarked. So what they would do is they would hijack the plane, take it to an area, take the passengers off, separate the Jews from the non-Jews, and take the plane on television and blow it up. Now, a fifth aircraft was El Al flight from Tel Aviv to New York with a stop in Amsterdam. Two hijackers, a Nicaraguan American man and a Palestinian woman, her name is Leila Khalid, they attempt to take the plane over after it took off from Amsterdam. Bad idea, don't try to hijack an El Al plane. The male hijacker was shot immediately by the onboard sky marshal and later died of his injuries while the female was overpowered. In 1972, a flight operated by Sabena Airlines from Vienna to Tel Aviv was taken over by four members of the Palestinian Black September movement. At their direction, the plane at Lod Airport near Tel Aviv, Lod Airport, by the way, today is called Ben Gurion Airport. So if you go to Israel with me, you go to Ben Gurion Airport. It's Lod Airport at this time. Now, the following day, an IDF commando team approached the aircraft disguised as aviation technicians. They killed the two male hijackers. They captured the two female hijackers. Now, what's interesting about this is that when you think about your politicians that you have here, whether it's Donald Trump or Barack Obama or the Bushes or the Clintons, they have a different pedigree, a different background than a lot of the prime ministers do that come from Israel. Now, the commando raid was commanded by Ehud Barak, who goes on to be prime minister of Israel. And one of the other commandos who was wounded in the operation was none other than Benjamin Netanyahu. So these guys are all guys that a lot of them that have participated, like Menachem Begin, in war and are very familiar with dealing with terrorists. Now, one you may have seen, a movie just came out of it recently, is called Entebbe. Now, the Entebbe hijacking saga began on June 27, 1976. Two members of the Popular Front for Palestine and two from the German Baader-Meinhof gang hijacked an Air France plane on flight from Tel Aviv to Paris with a stop in Athens and then to Entebbe Airport. Entebbe Airport is in the country of Uganda. The hijackers boarded the plane in Athens. They were joined by reinforcements in Uganda. And the Ugandan dictator at the time was Idi Amin Dada Tutu. And if you don't know a lot about Idi Amin, he's a pretty bad dude. And on July 1st, some of the passengers were released, but 100 of those passengers remain, including all the Israelis and the members of the crew. Now, just to give you an idea, here's a map. You can see where Tel Aviv is, Benghazi, Athens, and Entebbe. And so the game plan is that the IDF and the Mossad together would have a sneak attack here into Entebbe. When they get off the plane, they land in the airport quietly. A lot of these planes, to avoid detection over Egypt, because they had to fly over Egypt, were flying like at 300, 500 feet. Imagine in a C-130 or flying that low. But that's what they did. And they flew for a long period. The Kenyans were happy to help, and they got refueling in Kenya to make this all work. And then what happens is when they land in Entebbe, they had the exact type of Land Rover vehicle that Idi Amin had and some other cars that were in his entourage. So it looked like he was showing up. And so what happened is the Mossad people and the IDF people just rolled right up to where the terminal was. And before the Ugandans and the terrorists knew what to do, They took out the Ugandans mostly with silencers, and then they broke in. The hostages were mostly unguarded at the time. They were in a general assembly area, and the hijackers do what hijackers do. They were watching TV or playing video games in another room, and so basically the hostages were like, they're over there. And so what happens is the Israelis break in. They free the people, most of them. There are passengers that do die in this, and there's also a man who dies in it. And the man who dies, that's one of the commanders, is Netanyahu's brother. Benjamin Netanyahu's brother is one man who dies in this. And this was an incredible operation to pull off from that far away. Most of the international community condemned the Israelis for doing it. The United States said probably we would have done the same. Finally, the Russians came over and said, okay. And the Arab nations didn't think this was a great idea whatsoever. But frankly, it was a fantastic operation that saved a lot of people's lives. So a couple of the other things I just want to mention quickly that happened during this time. When you can't fight wars conventionally, you get into terrorism. How many of you remember Munich? And that was really tough. Happens during the 1972 Olympic Games. This is the first time the Olympics are back in Germany since Berlin. And since Nazism is rooted out of Germany. And the whole thing ends with a huge gunfight. All terrorists, or five of them, die. 9 hostages die in the plane. Almost all of the people that are in the weightlifting and wrestling are all killed. And what happens in this, the Israeli athletes and their trainers were really super nervous about going. And a lot of their family members, remember this next generation, a lot of their parents and grandparents have been victims of the Holocaust. And now you're going to go back into a country that killed a lot of your family and a lot of your friends. In the first few days, the Olympic Games went smoothly. They went and saw Fiddler on the Roof, and then went back to the Olympic Village to sleep. And then about 4 a.m., 8 members of the Palestinian terrorist group broke in. They're part of Black September. They jumped a 6-foot fence, and they killed and mutilated some right there in the room, and the rest eventually were in helicopters, and one of the terrorists threw a hand grenade in one of the helicopters and killed everybody, and it was an awful, awful thing. And our country, you can see this is one of the Black September terrorists. This is a world famous picture. It's just about everywhere, and they're trying to negotiate. The Germans were trying to negotiate for the release, and it didn't work out that way. And then from terrorism, then, you know, we get to different things. And this is what's called the First Intifada. Have you heard of the Intifadas? There are 2 of them. And Intifada is interesting. This is 1, and this is 2. Intifada is an Arab word. It means shaking off. We're shaking you off. And so the Arabs weren't getting what they wanted. And so what happens is there are fake charges of Israeli atrocities and instigations in mosques. Remember last week I told you, where does Hamas work? They work in mosques. That's where they get people fired up. And that's what they do here at Intifada 1, which starts in 1987. You can see what's happening in this. It is a crazy time period in the Gaza, also in the West Bank. And so many people are going to die in this process. Here's a second intifada, also called the Al-Aqsa Intifada. Now, Al-Aqsa is the Al-Aqsa Mosque, right? Remember the Al-Aqsa Mosque? Where is it? It's on the Temple Mount. And here's a second one, and this is after the Oslo peace agreements to come up. We'll talk about those in a second. And Ariel Sharon, who's prime minister, decided, you know what, I'm going to go on the Temple Mount. He was flanked by 1,000 police officers. And from that, Intifada II started in September of 2000. And it was pretty, pretty bad. And then beyond the Intifadas, then you have the bombings. People ask about the wall. Why is there a wall in Jerusalem? Why is there a wall in the West Bank? Well, people, if there was not a security wall and a security fence, we would not be going on any trips whatsoever to Israel. Because when you look at this, this is a bombing at the Sbarro Pizza place. If you went with me to Israel, this is right in the shopping mall I took you into right by the Jaffa Gate. And here 21 people, mostly children, were killed by Palestinian terrorists who blew themselves up, specifically around little children and Westerners. The Jaffa Road bus bombings were terrorist attacks on the number 18 buses in Jerusalem and Israel, 1996. It's all Hamas work. 45 people in downtown, right near the old city. And I could go on. I have a list. I mean, it just on and on. 1996 bombings, 97 bombings, 98 bombings, 99. And what happens is you have all of these bombings that are happening, mostly in Jerusalem, some in Tel Aviv. And finally, the government says, we've got to find a different way. And the different way is the security fence. And they put the security fence up. And there are lots of things I want to show you about the security wall that I think are really, really important. Some people say that the security fence, as an example, is a racist fence. It fences out of the Arabs. Not true. This is the fence right here. And by the way, this fence line right here, only 7% of it is the big giant fence that you see on television that looks really offensive. 90% of it is just a very small, what I would call fence with some barbed wire that's probably this high. That's probably 96, 95% of it. But 1.5 million Arabs live outside the fence. So the fence isn't like an ethnic thing or anything else like that. It's really designed for one thing, security. And guess what's happened with the bombings? From the intifadas to the bombings I just showed you in Jerusalem over time, way up here, and now into 2007, 2008, very, very, very few. They've dropped almost 98%. So the security fence here for them works perfectly until they can be assured that the people on the other side of the fence don't want to kill them. And we've seen a lot of that. Right here, right here, right here. And all of that has stopped primarily as a result of that fence. Arabs and the Jews attempt a political peace. Here's 1977. Remember I told you this was a time period where everything changed. And for the first time, a right-winger becomes a prime minister. His name is Menachem Begin, first non-socialist prime minister. And he takes the Likud bloc, secured the mandate to form a government after the parliamentary elections. Now, you know, I think he had 50 votes, something like that, 50 people that were with him. So how many would he have to find? Just 11 to have it. Or if you did the math and knew how the other ones were spread out, you wouldn't even need 61. He also became the first Israeli prime minister to meet officially and publicly with an Arab head of state when he welcomed Egyptian President Anwar Sadat to Jerusalem in November 1977. So the left-wing people in Israel are talking about peace. They're talking about giving land back. And now you've got Begin in power. And Begin's like, you know what? Let's give land back. Let's start making peace with our enemies. So all the left-wing people are like, you want to do what? And so they had to go along with everything that he was talking about and trying to make peace first with the Egyptians. And who's that? That's Anwar Sadat. So not only is he the first person that was officially and publicly invited to Jerusalem, but what Sadat is doing here, he's addressing the Knesset. He's addressing the Congress in Israel. And he's laying out his plan for peace with Israel. These meetings led to these meetings. And so we have the idea of conventional war doesn't work. Terrorism certainly is not working. And now Sadat leads a delegation to the ensuing peace negotiation, and Sadat, that's Jimmy Carter, and it's called the Camp David Accords, and that happens in September of 78. In March 79, he and Sadat signed the Egypt-Israel peace treaty, with Carter witnessing the event on the White House lawn in Washington, D.C. As a result of it, Begin and Sadat shared the 1978 Nobel Peace Prize for their efforts. It brought peace with neutralizing the largest Arab army of them all, with whom Israel had fought five wars. But it was also a traumatic sight given the extensive tangible concessions required of Israel, especially uprooting families that had settled on the Sinai. They had to get out. And that was very, very difficult. Now, Sadat made peace with Israel. He's the first Arab to do this. And he gets the Sinai, the oil-rich Sinai, back for it. Land for peace, just like Israel said it would do. And here's some other pictures of Begin and Sadat. These are all at Camp David. These are the unfortunate pictures in Egypt. And you know what those are pictures of? They're pictures of Anwar Sadat's assassination. Because the Muslim Brotherhood, Hamas, and all the people that are just the largest form of terrorists that are involved in the Palestinian movement wouldn't have it. You see the man that's right here? This was the guy that did it all. And he was part of the military of Egypt. And he assassinates Sadat. He assassinates a whole group of other people that are with Sadat as well. So sometimes peace comes at a great cost. The Knesset elections of 1981 returned the Likud-led coalition government back in power. So Begin plays through. The next thing are called the Oslo process, or the Oslo Accord. There you go. Israel and the Palestinians shaking hands together. And this time a new president is at the head of this one, and his name is Bill Clinton. And the Oslo process of 93 stops the expansion of Israeli settlements in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. You see that in the news today, right? Is the Palestinians don't want Jewish people building more settlements in the Western Bank. Israeli withdrawals were on a fixed schedule as a result of this peace treaty. And basically the PA, the Palestinian Authority, would control 90% of the Gaza Strip and the Western Bank. And today they control all the Gaza Strip. And then eventually they'd be returning to what borders? The 1967 borders. Now, the second expectation centered around increased economic development in the Palestinian society, lifting Palestinians out of the crushing poverty that they live in and narrowing the gap in living standards between them and the Israelis. Israeli expectations mostly centered on, what do they care the most about? Security. Security. The Palestinians would have to consider organizations such as Hamas and the Islamic Jihad as a threat to its own existence, and they need to be aligning with Israel in fighting terrorism. The first Israeli withdrawal was from the Palestinian territories, the Gaza Strip, and of Jericho. And the establishment of the Palestinian authorities and Yasser Arafat's installation as the very first president followed. A second Israeli redeployment occurred outside the larger Palestinian cities and the towns in the West Bank, and an Israeli third deployment never happens. And the reason is that the Palestinians are not making good on it. There's no free right or free passage route that connects the West Bank to the Gaza Strip. Running through the Israeli territory was never realized. That was one of the things they wanted to be able to do. And Israeli observers who were watching all this noted that the number of Palestinians and arms and types of armaments being brought into the authority territory was significantly exceeding the limits established by the agreements. What that means is the greatest Israeli anger was elicited by the fact that the PA was doing little to prevent terrorist attacks emanating from the territory. So remember, the PA's got to be on the side of, man, terrorism's got to end. And what's happening is there are terrorists that hop over on one side and they blow somebody up or they kill some Jewish people. They come back to the other side and they're giving a hero's welcome by the PA. And the Israelis are watching that going, wait a second, what do we do the Oslo thing for? But I think the greatest thing, when you're looking at Palestinians and you're looking at the Israeli government, is economics. And we'll talk about economics in a greater detail here in a moment. But when you think about economics and cost of living and how things are doing and jobs and are people really flourishing in your environment, you can see that in Israel, but certainly that's not clear in the Palestinian movement. And let me share with you why. The economic reconstruction of the Palestinian territories was a huge part of the Oslo Accords. And it was to be handled by respected Palestinian economists and business people working along with the World Bank and financial support of, guess this, Western donations. So there's a lot of people out here that want to donate to that. All those plans were halted by one man, and his name was Yasser Arafat. The economy in the Palestinian Authority was, since its inception, run as if it were a syndicate. And what that means is have monopolistic control over the sectors. It granted individuals or institutions in return for percentage kickbacks paid to authority figures in a pyramid that goes all the way back to, you got it, Arafat's very own office. So the Palestinian economy went into a downward spiral. And by the time of the second Intifada, it led to the permanent Israeli disclosure or closures and choking off all of its trade. And for all intents and purposes, the Palestinian economy is in a deep depression and coma. The United Nations is another way of getting peace, right? There, it's a peace organization. And what's interesting about the United Nations is their role in dealing with the nation of Israel. On December 6, 2018, the United Nations General Assembly failed to pass a resolution condemning Hamas, which is a terrorist group that rules the Gaza Strip. The United Nations would not do it. Hamas's charter approvingly cites Adolf Hitler, calls for Israel's destruction and the genocide of all Jewish people. After extensive pro-Hamas lobbying by the PLO itself, a former U.S. designated terror group with American and Israeli blood on its hands, the resolution condemning the Gazan terror group for repeatedly firing rockets into Israel, for inciting violence, thereby putting civilians at risk, totally 100% failed. The resolution entitled Activities of Hamas and Other Militant Groups in Gaza actually received a majority of the votes. The UN, of course, was founded due to Nazi war aggression, and we lost a lot of the Jewry of this world through that. Yet today, the United Nations attacks the Jewish state ad nauseum, and it's not an opinion to say as much, it's a fact. I was reading something in the Washington Post. The Washington Post report on the General Assembly vote describes the UN's anti-Israel bias as a perception. It's not reality. It's not really happening. And the Post, among other newspapers that often minimize the UN's institutional mistreatment of Israel by presenting it as merely a claim by Israel and its supporters. But in the case of perception, this perception is reality. In 2018, the United Nations General Assembly passed 21 resolutions condemning Israel, and a mere 6 for the entirety of the rest of the world. Let me say that again. In 2018, the United Nations General Assembly passed 21 resolutions condemning Israel, and a mere 6 for the rest of the international community. Israel, a democracy, is condemned 7 times more than North Korea, which still runs gulags and is the subject of just a mere 3 resolutions. The General Assembly adopted 9 resolutions against Israel, all the while ignoring human rights situations in China, Venezuela, Saudi Arabia, Cuba, Turkey, and Pakistan. And one of those resolutions even condemned Israel for repressive measures against Syrian people. Although the United Nations itself has largely failed to condemn or punish Syrian dictator Bashar Assad for murdering his own people. I think it's more than a perception. I think that's a reality. Desert Storm and a large immigration from Russia and Africa. Here's another picture of two great guys right here that are talking about peace. The peace led to that man's death as well. He was assassinated. And here it is. You have Jordan and and Israel for the first time making peace together. King Hussein actually sitting there going, let's have peace with my friends from Israel. They smoked a good cigarette over it. Cost that man his life. Who was he assassinated by? He was assassinated by an ultra crazy Jewish guy, a guy that didn't want peace with the people of Jordan or anyone else, and it cost him his life in Tel Aviv. These are a lot of the immigrations, and we will go through them very, very quickly because some things happen that are just amazing. Look at all the people. These are people that are on a 747. I don't think they have their seatbelts latched, and I don't think they're sitting at all. And here are some of the others that are on another 747. Do you ever go feel? I feel that way when I fly, but I've never flown that way. The Gulf crisis comes to Israel on the same side of the great majority of the Arab states, including Syria. So Israel now, in this Gulf war against Iraq, finds itself on the same side as Syria, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait. That created a huge problem. The Arabs wanted one thing out of the Gulf War. They just want a reversal of the Iraqi aggression, give Kuwait their property back, let's get out of this. Israel wanted complete destruction of Iraq's war-making potential. Israel, for the first time in their lives, were not allowed to defend themselves, and those are Scud missiles being shot at Tel Aviv. And the guy that was president then was the first George Bush, and he wouldn't give Israel any of the military codes so they could coordinate with any fighters or anything else, and he gave them a stern, you're sitting this thing out, even if it means sitting here and having Scud missiles shot at you. During Desert Storm, Israeli security forces, they used live ammunition on the Temple Mount, and that's the Temple Mount right there, and they had a Muslim riot, and 21 demonstrators died in it. The Arab Coalition, along with the United States, condemned Israel for this, and it was a very big problem right in the middle of the Gulf War. Israeli planes eventually bomb and destroy an atomic reactor near Baghdad that would enable Iraq to manufacture nuclear weapons. Begin justify the actions. This is before Gulf War, as having been essential to prevent evil. Saddam Hussein was someone that would be attacking Israeli cities with atomic bombs if he had those, similar to Hiroshima. At least 25 pounds of enriched uranium were reported to have been on site, and Begin said that that the $275 million facility near completion was scheduled to go into operation. It was flattened to the ground. And the country that helped Iraq the most for this was France. It was a lot of the French people. So let's quickly go through this immigration thing because I want to just give you some of the numbers on this. Operation Solomon was a covert Israeli military operation to airlift Ethiopian Jews to Israel from May 24th to 25th, 1991. Nonstop flights of 35 Israeli aircrafts, including C-130s and 747s. Ready for this number, fill in 2 days? They transported 14,325 Ethiopian Jews to Israel, and they did it in 36 hours. The 1990s post-Soviet Aliyah began en masse in the late 80s. Soviet Union opened their borders to allow Jews to leave for the country of Israel. Between 89 and 2006, 1.6 million Soviet Jews, as defined by the law of returns, immigrated to the Soviet Union. About 979,000, or 61%, migrated to Israel. Another 325,000 migrated to the United States, and 219,000 to Germany. That's a lot of people. The Jewish people, even to this day, do you remember the Vietnamese, the boat people? Do you remember that whole thing? Everyone was saying, no, I don't want to have any part of the boat people, not do it. That's not what this country did. They said, we'll take them. And they went and they flew and they rescued many of the boat people, brought them to Israel, and made them citizens of Israel in itself. So let's talk about Israel, a world leader, and we can be done. I just want to remind you, is this a great picture? Yeah, everyone says it's the size of New Jersey. Jersey's bigger. So there's one picture I want you to take in. Here's the next one. little purple right there. Only democracy in the area. And all the other yellow, those are all Arab countries that have a very strong disdain for the purple. Imagine waking up every morning and thinking, that's your neighborhood? It's a tough neighborhood to live in. It's a very difficult neighborhood to live in. Israel is a world leader. It's a country of very limited natural and financial resources, and is yet not at peace with some of its neighbors. It made Israel's scientists and engineers constantly faced with the challenge of quickly devising new and innovating solutions such as drip irrigation or the Merkava tank. The Merkava tank is a specific tank that was developed by the Israelis for desert fighting. History and geography have made Israelis adept at identifying problems, finding solutions, and shortening the development process to turn them into commercial products. Here's a country, again, if you think about how small they are, you think about the neighborhood they live in, they must be resourceful, they must work at things quickly. These are people that work very hard and are very effective. Over the last decade, Israel R&D prowess has rapidly expanded out of the military sphere, and the universities and research institutes where it was originally concentrated to create what is widely acknowledged as a model for high-tech economy. Tel Aviv is second only to the Silicon Valley in terms of high tech. Israel is second only to the United States on a per capita basis in its ability to generate new technology-based companies with innovative, market-focused products. Israel makes up only 1/6 of 1% of the landmark or landmass of the Middle East. I just showed it to you. 24% of Israel's workforce hold university degrees, ranking third in the industrialized world, after the U.S. and Holland, and 12% hold advanced degrees. Israel has the third highest rate of entrepreneurship and the highest rate among women and among people over 55 in the world. Israel is the only country in the world that has entered 21st century with a net gain in number of these things that are so important to the world today. Trees. They're the only country that has actually got more trees over time than less. And if you go with me anytime, I can show you all the forests that they're planting in Israel. With more than 3,000 high-tech companies and startups, Israel has the highest concentration of high-tech companies in the world apart from the Silicon Valley. Israel has one of the highest percentages in the world of home computers per capita. It has been at the forefront of some of the major technological advances in recent years, including some of the development for the first cell phone, which is believed to have been done in Israel by Motorola. Motorola has its largest development center in Israel to this day. Most of Windows NT operating system was developed by Microsoft Israel. The Pentium MX chip technology was designed in Israel at Intel. And some of the voicemail technology was also developed in Israel. Israel is high-tech in a lot of ways. Even their banknotes have Braille on them so blind people can identify them properly. Israel has the fourth largest air force in the world, behind the United States, Russia, and China. Life expectancy, 82 years and greater, which is more than the United Kingdom and the United States and Germany. And about 90% or 93% of Israeli homes use solar energy for water heating, and that's the highest percentage in the world by far. You get even lower car insurance. Do you know if you tell your car insurance provider that you are observant of Shabbat, they will take out 52 Saturdays. They figured out how to do that. So you don't get charged for that. Would that be kind of nice? But we have to drive to church, so it doesn't work for us at all. But if you compare this whole idea, if you step back, and I just want to have a couple closing thoughts about all of this. Clearly what is happening in Israel and what has happened in the 20th century has been a work of God. And it's been a work of God because in the Bible, a long time ago, God made a promise to Abraham, and he made those same promises to Isaac and Jacob, that this land that we've been studying for the last 4 weeks would be given to the Jewish people. And that's been fulfilled. And we said clearly last week, the Jewish people that are here today, are they biblical Israel? And we're going to say, no. No, they're not. Matter of fact, most of the people that live in Israel today are secular. They're not reading their Torah. They're not even good Orthodox Jewish people in the sense of being religiously minded. But God works in such amazing ways that for the Christian church, and we know how the end of the story works out for us, looking at places like the book of Revelation and thinking about end times. And the end times always include that place and a place called the New Jerusalem. And so this little piece of prophecy should be an encouragement to you and I. It should be an encouragement that the Bible, again, has found to be true and valid. And it should be an encouragement that God is moving and working. When we think about the Israeli-Palestinian issue today, it is a hot issue. And it will remain a hot issue. All of it will be solved simply by one side of the people looking at the Israelis and saying, let's live in peace. We say that you have a right to live and exist and have a sovereign right to this piece of property. That happens, man, give me a Nobel Peace Prize, because that's the only way this gets solved. And then when you think about the idea economically, think about the economics of this. Think about the number of people, governments, different educational institutions that are pro-Palestinian that have thrown countless amount of money into this. What are they doing with the invested money? Think about what Israel has done and think what the Palestinians have done. And no wonder the Palestinians are looking over the fence going, I'd rather have that. I'd rather have that car. I'd rather have that house. I'd rather live that way. And there's an economic aspect of it that's really huge. I have many friends that are on the other side of the Palestinian argument, and I had a discussion with a friend of mine a couple years ago, and he was saying that the people that live in Israel should give the land that they acquired in the 1967 war, that they should give it back to the Palestinians. And I said, well, what's your basis for that? He said, they stole it from them. They killed people for it. And I said, friend, where do you live? And he said, well, I live in Laguna Niguel. I said, do you own your property there? Yes, I do. I said, you got a mortgage? Oh, no. He said, I burned the mortgage. I own it outright. I said, as a show of your ideology, as a show of what you really believe in, what I'd like for you to do today is to take the property and turn it in and give it back to the Mexican government. Because here in Orange County, a group of ruthless, bloodthirsty white people came here. And they had guns and knives, and they killed innocent people, all for the property that this church stands on, the property that's here in Southern California. And I really wish we got the Baja too. I think we missed it on that one. But all of that. I said, be the first. Live the way you're speaking. I said, we should probably give land back to indigenous people, not just enough for a casino or in the middle of some desert somewhere. We don't care. Let's give them Chicago. Let's give them Manhattan. Let's give them something good. If we're going to do that. And he was like, you're out of your mind. And I said, you know what? You're out of your mind. Because what you're talking about, what the media is talking about, what the academics are talking about is absolutely pure hypocrisy. You would never do what you're asking the people of Israel to do yourself. I'm so thankful that there were these wars. I'm thankful that God's given this piece of property back. And I'm thankful for a personal reason for me, that I get to go. I love going to Israel. Jerusalem is my favorite city in the world. I love Jerusalem more than I love Chicago or Los Angeles or Manhattan or Zurich, you name the city. Man, there's just something about being in Jerusalem and standing on the Temple Mount or standing and looking down on the Temple Mount from the Mount of Olives and thinking, Jesus is going to come back here. We're going through the book of Acts right now, and we've already gone through the part where Jesus ascends to heaven. And the angel tells the people around there, he goes, you know what? He's gone, but he's going to come back here. I mean, I don't know about you, I pray hard every day that I turn my television set on, or somehow if I could see it, to know that where I've stood on the Mount of Olives, I know that my Lord and Savior is going to put his feet back on that mountain. And he is going to walk right down that Palm Sunday road, and he's going to walk right into and onto that Temple Mount. And what a glorious day that would be. I thank God for the ability to be able to walk that walk. And I've walked it several times. Never gets old. Without all of this, you'll never get to go. I'll never get to go back. So what a great thing it is that we can see biblical history with our own eyes by visiting Israel in itself. Let's pray. God, we continue to pray for the peace of the people of Israel. God, we know that that the world in so many ways is against this little country, but it's a testimony to your sovereignty. It's a testimony to your power and your strength that you take powerful and wise people and make fools of them. God, we read that in Scripture. We believe it. God, we pray for this little postage stamp country that's so important. It's important to the people that are in this room. It's important to me because just about everything that has happened in this history, in this world, happened there. And it has impacted us greatly. To think that Jesus Christ in the city of Jerusalem not only preached there, not only lived there, and did it in perfection, but he was arrested there, died on a cross there. He died on a cross for our sin, wrath that the Father poured out on him, meant for us. God happened in Jerusalem. And God, he defeated death and he defeated sin in that city through the resurrection. He resurrected in Jerusalem. He ascended to be at your right-hand side from Jerusalem. So God, thank you selfishly for giving us access to the city. God, we pray fervently that the last person can hop on the bus and we could be living in a new Jerusalem forever with you. And we pray that sincerely in your name. Amen.